We light our chalice, symbol of faith, for truth sought through a questioning heart and an attentive mind, and for love pursued through obstacles inside and outside our own human heart, and for forgiveness and all it entails, the place where truth and love meet and merge. By Vanessa Southern? Vanessa Southern, I think.
I like to tell guests and visitors when they come to Prairie to come several times. And the reason I say that is because we have a variety of different speakers and approaches to our services. Our speakers sometimes are our Reverend Sandy Ingham. They're members of our congregation. They're members of the wider community. And sometimes we get a professional speaker with a lot of expertise on her subject. And that's today's guest, Gail Reed. Gail is a former psychiatric nurse. She received her PhD from the University of Wisconsin in 2004. If it was 94, I wouldn't tell you, but 2004, in educational psychology. Her graduate advisor was Dr. Robert Enright, a nationally known leader in the development of forgiveness research, forgiveness therapy, and forgiveness education. Dr. Reed's research on forgiveness has demonstrated that a forgiveness recovery program resulted in psychological benefits for women with a history of spousal psychological abuse. This research has been published in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology, and she's been featured in national media such as the Jane Pauley Show. A second study revealed an association between forgiveness levels, finding meaning in suffering, and psychological health for people divorced due to infidelity. This study has been published in the International Forgiveness Institute's World of Forgiveness. Gail Reed is a member of the Speakers Bureau for International Forgiveness Institute, and she speaks nationally about forgiveness therapy and its beneficial outcomes. I hope you'll join me in greeting Dr. Reed.
I am so glad to be with you. What a good job to have to go and talk about forgiveness. I'm blessed. I'm truly blessed. As you see, my talk is about what's so good about forgiving your enemy, forgiveness as human flourishing. And believe me, we've seen this over and over again, the blessings of forgiveness. Next, I'm going to raise my hand to you, Penny. Okay. I'm going to go through really quickly, because we have about 25 minutes, the conceptual foundations of our therapy, the benefits of forgiveness therapy, an in-depth, quick look at forgiveness therapy, and a brief overview of forgiveness education. Next slide, please, Peggy. Robert Enright is head of our program. He has a program in the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the International Forgiveness Institute, which has been going since 1996. I was his first communications director. As you already heard about my credentials, but I always say the reason I'm standing up here is because I'm a human being, and I've done rotten things to other people, and they've done rotten things to me. And so I understand about forgiveness because I've been living with that process the whole time. Okay, next one, here's the contributions, we think, of our program of the psychology of forgiveness, a definition of forgiveness, a process steps of forgiving, so it can slow down, a measure of forgiving, which we won't talk too much about, but it helps us in our research, research on the benefits of forgiveness therapy. We have a lot of evidence-based treatment protocols. And forgiveness education, which is going on Northern Ireland, Taiwan, the Philippines, Palestine, Israel, Greece, Milwaukee, Madison, so some of the places we need it here too. So the next one is, forgiveness therapy is essentially a cognitive therapy, it's a moral therapy, but we hope when we talk about what is forgiveness, how do I forgive, and we'll go through those four phases later, moral feelings and moral behavior follow that. So it includes empathy and moral feelings toward the other person. And Penny was just talking about in the story she told, if we don't do this, we exclude ourselves from the human community, or we exclude the wrongdoer from the human community. and that's not good. Those embers go out then, right, don't they? Right. And our conceptual foundations are one of yours. We absolutely believe in inherent equal human moral worth, and it leads to moral love. Inherent worth plus wrongdoing is still inherent worth. Inherent worth plus harm done is still inherent worth. We talk a lot to people who have done wrong things. They're still worthy human beings. We go into prisons and tell them that, and you see these men crying, okay? We talk to people who have been hurt in our therapy programs. They're crying because they want to reclaim that inherent sense of inherent worth. It's true, it's true, it's true, but some people, they don't believe it because they've been hurt or they've hurt other people. Go to the next slide, please. We really believe worldview is important here. We're not just psychologists. We're butting up against people's beliefs. And we don't impose our beliefs on them, nor do we impose the absence of their beliefs. I give out a worldview sheet when I take people into my clinical practice and let them say that's a resource for me. They want to bring it to the table, they can. If they don't want to, they don't have to. But that's a resource. Your spiritual life or your moral life is a resource. So again, I'm going to nag about this. Inherent human worth goes to moral love. That's human flourishing, right? And no matter what's been done to you or what you've done to someone else, you still have that worth. Nothing, nothing, nothing takes that away. How many people in prison do you think have been abused as children? 100%, right. That's right. That's right. Next slide. We're developmental psychologists. We're not just clinical psychologists, although some of us are that too. We think we have the psychological process that helps people adapt to the things that have happened to them. We forgive with a good psychological definition, a good process. We choose and work, we feel better, we have psychological health. But we have an identity as a forgiver over time, right? So we choose and work over time. I change as a person, I have identity development, I find meaning in suffering. Who knows Viktor Frankl in here? Anybody read his work? I do good in the face of wrong, and I change in virtue, right? That's part of forgiveness. So we see that, next slide, please. If we identify with this forgiveness and virtues, we get spiritual growth or moral growth, whatever you want to call it. This great news is what makes the good news of psychological health happen, in my view. And I have some research showing that. Spiritual growth or moral growth, I choose virtue in the face of wrongdoing, is the great news that leads to the good news of psychological health. So it's more than a sort of a therapy approach. There's something about the person choosing moral growth that makes a difference. Next slide, please. We talk about worldview. Who am I? What do I believe? Who do I want to become? How do I face unfair suffering? How do I face unfair suffering? How many people do you think are going to have unfair suffering in their life? 100%, right. How does my worldview help me? How does my community help me? My congregation help me? Next slide, please. So we answer these questions. I'm a person that's a human being, part of the human community. I have people that I admire, ideal figures that I admire who have done forgiveness. What is wrong? Injustice and betrayal, both by myself and by other people, unfair suffering. What's the solution? What is the solution? I'm talking kind of fast because I knew we had a short time. Forgiveness and asking for forgiveness and being a forgiver. That's the solution. Desmond Tutu has a book that he wrote, Without Forgiveness, There Is No Future. Isn't that true? No. Anyway, how's my worldview help me? You support people in that, right? Next slide, please, Peggy. This is our research outcomes. And I'm just going to go through them briefly. They have many more, but we have incest survivors, my research, psychological abuse, and incest survivors. When people have domestic violence, how many of them do you think were incested also? About 30-40%. And that's overall in the population. Anyway, women and children after divorce, adolescent bully victims, school children. This is, I stated where we're doing those things. Drug and alcohol addicted people, end of life. We're working on bringing forgiveness therapy to prisons. We've been giving a bunch of talks up there. We have a woman named Maria Gambaro, one of our colleagues, and Chaplain Teslick and Chaplain O'Boyle, who are running ad hoc forgiveness therapy groups. With this book, this is our forgiveness therapy, is summed up in this book. I use notebooks because I have specific people I work with. I'll show you the notebook. This is one of my notebooks for spousal abuse, but it's the same therapy, essentially. And we're just getting research going up there so we can prove this. We want forgiveness therapy to be on the table for every prisoner that walks in the door of a prison as an offering. But right now, the 2 years this has been going, about six or seven men have moved from maximum security to medium security. They're doing so much better, which is good news. And they get more resources there and everything. So, next slide, please, Peggy. The benefits of forgiveness therapy are decreases in anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, anger, aggression, shame, toxic shame, drug and alcohol vulnerability, increases in hope, self-esteem, well-being, social skills, finding meaning in suffering, sense of inherent worth, which you give to the wrongdoer, then you get it back for yourself, sense of purpose. Next slide, please. What's the problem, do you think? Think about this as we go through this. We'll talk about it later in the discussion. Next slide. Unresolved anger, anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress, the opposite of those benefits. Low self-esteem, diminished self-worth, diminished relationships, poor decision-making, susceptibility to substance abuse, lack of meaning and purpose. Next slide, please. There's another thing, though, in what's the problem is. When people can't get justice because it's a family member that's done something and it's not illegal, and usually most wrongdoings are that, right? They're in the family, or community, betrayals. People will rehearse the abuse or the wrongdoing over and over again. It's called rumination or cognitive rehearsal. And what are they doing that for? They want a different ending. And they can't get it. They can't go back and change the situation. They can't make the wrongdoer be what he or she was not at the time. And they can't get justice of any kind, usually. So it keeps the wrongdoer on the hook. Repetitive, resentful retelling, identity as a victim and with other victims, and it brings psychological distress. But that's felt to be protective. The person can't hurt me again. What does it do? It keeps you stuck. People that do this cannot recover. And finding meaning in suffering, as a la Viktor Frankl, is the antidote to that, which my research has shown. So we need to get people, yes, they can tell their story, they're angry about it, but they need to move toward a solution. And the solution is, they do have a new ending to the story. They're in control of their forgiveness. That's the ending to the story. They can't get justice, but they can forgive. And that does not depend on the justice system or the wrongdoer. You can independently forgive before the wrongdoer is ready to receive it. You need to keep the gift in your hand until it's safe to give it, right? But you can still do that before the wrongdoer is ready or before there's any justice. Next slide, please. So I'm going to just show you my research really quickly. Next slide, please. Negative outcomes for these women, the spousal abuse. Verbal abuse is worse than physical abuse in terms of outcomes. Psychological outcomes and stress-related illness outcomes. So the negative outcomes for these women were debilitating resentment. Some of these women were out 2 years from the marriage, some 20 years, and they're still depressed, okay? Anxiety, depression, PTSD, low self-esteem and self-worth, learned helplessness, especially about the relationship. Next slide, please. The accusatory suffering, big deal for these women. I got this out of domestic abuse literature, this idea, and this is what happens. They're taught to mourn, get angry, be more assertive and so on, but they don't learn to forgive and they get stuck in this accusatory suffering. So I've already told you about that. But some of these women were playing the story over and over in their mind, maybe once or twice a day, three or four times a day, at least once or twice a week. That's a lot of energy being wasted. Go next slide, please. I'm just gonna go through these results really good, but really quickly. But I had a regular therapy group, the mourning, the anger, the assertiveness group, and then I had this group, the forgiveness therapy group. And I loved all these women, and so I was really doing good, I thought, with the anger, or the regular therapy group, the alternate therapy group. the therapy that most women get in this situation. And I thought, my gosh, I'm going to ruin my results because they're both doing so well. I love them both. I'm doing such a good job. When I looked at the results, the alternative therapy with the mourning and assertiveness and so on, moved in self-esteem just about this much. No statistical significance of that movement, especially not as compared to the other one. These depression, anxiety, self-esteem, PTSD, decision-making, both practical and moral, finding meaning and suffering, and decrease in victim status, forgiveness group, just huge changes. And did I do that with my forgiveness therapy? No. These brave women did this by choosing to work on it. They're the ones that are the heroes here. Right, next slide, please. Of course, I'm going again about finding meaning and suffering. That and inherent worth, I'm going to harp on those. Difficulty is opportunity for growth. Can't change what has happened. Can change oneself. Identify with a virtue or forgiveness hero. Reclamation of your inherent worth plus the wrongdoer's inherent worth. This is huge. We see, and I had these women write stories before and after, and you see the movement to this after forgiveness. Really cool. Next slide, please. We're going to go through our forgiveness therapy, what we usually do over months, in about 15 minutes. So we'll do that really fast. We do a definition, because we don't want people trying to forgive when they're afraid, because they have misunderstandings about it. And then we go through, how do I forgive? This is a process. We slow it down, people to go step by step, but we're going to run through it really quickly. What is forgiveness? And we can talk about this afterwards. There's misunderstandings about it, confusions with other concepts. I want you to be thinking about this. You can discuss it with me later. Family or peer group pressure brings quick forgiveness. Traumatic bonding, I go back to somebody who's going to punch me in the face and get close to his fist and try to help him. And that's forgiveness. That's not forgiveness. You need to forgive and set safe boundaries. Unforgiveness, which people will go, I'm forgiving you, but I'm still mad at you. I'm a good person. I'm forgiving you. I'm still mad at you. And people will do this. Next slide, please. What is forgiveness? We're going to go through really quickly. It's moral. The wrongdoing is morally wrong. It's not just a misunderstanding or a difference in culture or confusion. It's morally wrong. It hits your inherent worth. It's against your inherent worth. The response is also moral. I want to give you goodness as a human being. I want to promote your human flourishing. Okay, next slide, please. The goodwill, next slide, is in two ways, restraint from resentment. As Penny was saying, resentment doesn't hurt the wrongdoer, it hurts you. It does. It reveals there's pain there still. But people will say that resentment's like drinking a poison and thinking it's gonna hurt the other person. And the gifts of moral love are not hoping they have a good job or hoping they have a good, nice car or a nice house. It means you wish them well as a developing human being. You wish them human flourishing. And when we identify what the wrongdoing is, we hope the person will change their ways that led them to that wrongdoing. Next slide, please. It's paradoxical. It's not about them when you forgive, because you choose that freely for yourself. But it is about them because you want them to have goodness. And so it heals you in return, which is an amazing idea. I've seen it happen over and over again. It's a blessing. It's beyond duty. No one can tell you to do it, not even me, not even all our science. Next slide, please. It's a process, we think. And it's an unwieldy process. You go forward, you go back, you revisit some steps. And it's a lifelong process, I think. Next slide, please. The foundations, again, are inherent human worth. Respect, appropriate limits, moral love. Moral love is not familial love, it's not friendship love, it's not romantic love. It's hope for the ultimate welfare of the wrongdoer. Thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are consistent with this hope, whether or not you can get close to the wrongdoer. Okay, next slide, please. What forgiveness is not? Think about these things. Go ahead. It's not forgetting or denial. Next slide. It's not condoning. It wasn't that bad. He didn't hit me, he only swore at me. It's still wrong. Next slide, please. It's not excusing. This is really important. You don't say, his father hit him, so he can't help but hit me. That's not right. He might need lots of therapy to stop hitting you, because he needs help. He or she needs help. But we want to preserve the wrongness of it, because we need to know that to forgive, but also we want to preserve the wrongdoer's dignity of human choice. He or she could choose to do better, even if he or she needs a lot of help. We want to preserve that dignity. Next slide. And it's not condemning. I'm a forgiving person, you're not, so I'm better than you. It's not that. And that can be very subtly wrong. Next slide, please. It's not excusing. It's not excusing. It's truth and love. I was just say up there. Forgiveness is truth and love, and you talked about that, Penny. It's not seeking justice or compensation. If you waited for justice, how long might you be waiting? A long time. And can you actually get justice for the betrayal? Nothing touches that but forgiveness, I don't think. Nothing touches it. You could get all the money in the world, all the apologies in the world, all the new starts in the world, and the betrayal still happens. Next slide, please. It's not simply saying, I forgive you. In fact, it might be dangerous to do that if the wrongdoer doesn't believe he or she has done something wrong. You might not be ready to hear that. Next slide, please. It's not a grim obligation. You have to because someone told you or you're not a good person. Next slide, please. It's not reconciliation. True forgiveness wants reconciliation, but true forgiveness is one person's moral choice. Next slide, Penny, please. It's one person's moral choice. But reconciliation is the moral response of both the injured and the injurer. And they're working toward building trust between the two of them. You might have partial reconciliation. If I have a friend who I had a business with and he used our company credit cards and gambled away all our money, I might say, I still want to be your friend, but I don't want to run a business with you anymore. Next slide, please. Barriers to reconciliation. The wrongdoer is still dangerous. The wrongdoer doesn't believe a wrongdoing has occurred. The wrongdoer is inaccessible, and the wrongdoer is dead. Sometimes you have to forgive people who've already died. You don't want to be like one of my friend's mothers, who is still mad at one of her family members, that every time she goes to a family funeral, she goes out in the graveyard and kicks this one person's gravestone. You don't want to be in that place. So, next slide, please. I'm going to skip this one. Go ahead. Now we're going to go to how do I forgive. We have four phases. We think this isn't the only way to do this process, but we think this helps people slow it down, open up, take steps gradually as they can, and so on. The uncovering phase, the decision phase. A lot of people think forgiveness is just the decision phase, the work phase, and the discovery or deepening phase. Next slide, please. Uncovering, we talk about psychological defenses like denial, displacement, repression, disassociation, identification. The main one I really care about here is displacement. If you're angry at somebody, who gets it usually? The kids around you or your family members. Repression, what happens? You're hurting yourself. You're holding it in. Identification means you believe the person who hurt you is the announcer of your inherent worth. Worthless, right? You believe that you're worthless, and that's not good. So we talk about that. What are you doing now? This is uncovering the injuries, essentially. Next slide, please. We talk about anger, good anger that motivates for change. You need to talk about it, say, what limits do you need to set? How can you change your own behavior? How can you ask for respect from the other person? Those kind of things. But destructive anger, blame, resentment, revenge, that doesn't hurt the other person, it kills you. The Chinese will say, if you want to take revenge, you better dig two graves, because it's going to hurt you as much as the other person. So next slide, please. Shame. Most people were hurt in a family setting. They do shame. They tell us it's our fault, or we believe it's our fault, because we can't get help and no one's giving us any other information than that. We talk about what's guilt, good guilt. You've broken a moral standard that you hold dear. That's guilt. You can change yourself then. But shame is an injury. It's an injury. Toxic shame is an injury. And we ask people, what do others say that I am in my faith community, in my friendship group, at my work, my other family members? What do they say about me? Not the same thing the injurer said about me. We ask them to collect that information. Next slide, please. Replaying the events, the old story, I already talked about that. We can tell it for validation and decisions, but the repetitive, intrusive retelling, that's a psychological symptom of anxiety and PTSD. So we want to move, and I promise people at this point, you can't change that old story, but you can say you're going to work toward the end of that story being forgiveness. Next slide, please. We talk about the energy loss of all this, all these injuries. This is exhausting. People come to us, they're exhausted. And we have to recognize the excessive focus on pain. And what do we do about that pain? We can't just ruminate about it. A lot of people do that. And forgiveness is one therapy. They need other help usually too, but it's one therapy that can help with this pain. Next slide, please. Recognizing permanent change. Sometimes you've been hurt financially, you've been hurt physically. You can't change those things. You've lost family or fortune or mobility in some instances from an accident. We have to realize the world's unfair. Is the world fair? It's really not. It is lovely, but it's unfair. It's all those things together. And we have to think, what is your worldview? What does your experience tell you about responding to unfair suffering? Again, how many people are going to experience unfair suffering? Okay, next slide, please. So you need to think about that. And so we also uncover resentment. Most people tell me they don't want to be resentful, but you know what? If you're not processing pain, you're resentful. And you're thinking revenge even if you don't do it. One woman in a conference, a Lutheran women's deacons, peacemaking conference, no less, she ran into a man who had deserted her at the altar some 30 years before and saw that he had had a rough life. He had become an alcoholic. As the woman he ran off divorced him, and she said, "Is it okay if I'm happy about that?" And I said, "No, that's not right. That's what you're asking." So that subtle revenge is not good. So we realize the current responses are not working. And we bring people to that slowly, and they decide when they want to move on. Go ahead. We have a decision phase, which is just one step, but it's the big step. Change of heart to pursue virtue in the face of difficulty. This is the beginning of finding meaning in suffering. Commitment to a process. I'm willing to do the hard work of forgiving the other person but facing my pain. And the idea is, what kind of a person can I become? The wrongdoing is not going to determine who I am. I'm going to choose that. How about, will my worldview and my friends and so on help me? What virtues will I pursue? Forgiveness, compassion, love, inclusion, those kind of things. Go to the next slide. I'm going to tell you one story just really quickly and have you think about your story. Anyone know who Marietta Yeager is? She was on the Discovery Channel. She was in one of our forgiveness conferences. She was a Catholic lady who kind of lapsed in her faith. This is in the 70s. They went for a family vacation to Montana, ironically right near where I grew up, and where Sacagawea was kidnapped. They're in the same campground there at the headwaters of the Missouri. Anyway, a Jeffrey Dahmer type person stole her little girl Susie and killed her. And at the time, they didn't have cell phone towers, of course, so they had to keep. He was calling her and taunting her. He was schizoaffective, most likely. And so they had to keep her on the phone with him so they could track where he was. And he was taunting her over and over again. And she got to the point where she finally said, "God, I just want to be like him. I want to kill him with my bare hands. I want to forgive, but I want your help to want to forgive." So she started seeing him differently. He's still wrong. He's still doing mean things. But she saw him as a hurt human being. And so she eventually worked toward the alleviation of the death penalty for him. She's still friends with his mother. And she moved out there, actually. But when she spoke about that, about her love for Susie, and so she forgave this man, she came up the walkway to do her talk. You could feel the power coming off of her, the forgiveness power. I'm saying, she's a powerful lady is what I'm saying. Next page, please. The work phase means a couple things. You just brought up all the pain we've suffered, right? All the injuries. We need to bear and grieve the pain. This isn't just like grieving. You're bearing the pain so you don't pass it back into yourself. That's grieving. But you don't pass it on to other people or back to the wrongdoer. That's the difference here. So you need to spend time on that. You have to grieve many things. The act itself or the pattern of actions. The unfairness. The losses. Again, I said, in order not to pass on the pain, we recommend people stand in a wave. We don't like pain. I don't like pain. I don't like it at all. It's no fun. I bet you don't like it either. But we recommend when grieving comes up, not to run away from it. If you run away from a wave on the beach, it's going to knock you down. If you stand and plant your feet and let the wave come up, it's going to go down again. You don't think it's going to, but it's going to go down again. And you can have a friend in one hand and a friend in the other hand, or a counselor. But you face the pain and learn something from it and process it. Maybe grieve one memory at a time. It'll go down and you can walk away stronger. We really recommend and becoming better, becoming stronger, choosing to be a transitional person in your place. And hurry up here and finish pretty quick. The other thing we do that's really important is reframe the wrongdoer. We look at the bigger picture of him or her. Doesn't excuse him or her. History and current context, they're vulnerable but culpable. They're a human being just like you. They have a bad background perhaps, but they're still culpable. And the main thing we say, they still have inherent human worth no matter what. And you're vulnerable too to doing wrongdoings, right? You don't excuse him or her, I mean that. But you're still wanting to grant him or her inherent human worth. And when people do this, I watch them say, aha, this wasn't about me, it's about their hurt. And I recognize that I'm valuable too. They reclaim their own inherent worth right here. Go ahead, please. You experience empathy and compassion for them. I'm going to go fast and have you go to the next slide, Penny. You do appropriate empathy, though, and compassion, what you can do for him, not getting him or her, not getting too close to get hurt again. You offer goodwill with moral love. Part one is merciful restraint. That's trying to not do the revenge, resentment thing. And if you see resentment come up, don't say, oh no, I'm a bad forgiver, I failed. Say, there must be pain there. I need to go back to the pain unit. I need to work through the pain. That resentment's covering up pain. Next slide, please. Part two is generosity and moral love. This isn't like giving a big tip to a waitress that did a good job. This is outrageous generosity. It's outrageous benevolence. It's benevolence that the person's actions didn't deserve. His or her inherent worth deserves that, but his actions didn't deserve that. We have to balance those two things, right? And it's moral love, again, wishing for his or her human flourishing. Next slide, please. We're into the discovery and deepening. You see again here, finding meaning and suffering, finding release and finding purpose. Go ahead. Finding meaning and suffering, well, we've already talked about that. Finding relief from resentment, anger, pain, anxiety, all the outcomes. Finding new purpose, reconciliation, helping others. Go ahead. Again, this is one of the key things about forgiveness. I think forgiveness is a way of finding meaning and suffering. So I've already read through this. But at the end, I'll say, I pursue virtue. I do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Who am I as I pursue virtue more than the injury, more than the view of the injurer, more than the victim, a loved and loving person, a triumphant, transformed person? It brings release and leads to purpose. Next slide, please. I'm just going to go ahead from those. We already covered those. Next slide. I'm going to skip that. Okay. Let love be genuine. This is a quote from Romans. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Next slide. Our forgiveness education, I'm going to go briefly and ask you to go to the website, and Dennis White will help you with this. Ireland, Greece, Israel, and Palestine, Liberia, inner city, USA, I think the Philippines also. Anyway, there's going to be a peace conference this summer in Israel and Palestine. Both the Israelis and Palestinians asked for this. A forgiveness conference. Next slide. Children are able to see that people have inherent worth, even though they don't have the cognitive ability to understand abstractly inherent human worth. They know they are inherently worthy. They're looking for affirmation of inherent worthiness. And older children and adolescents can consciously choose forgiveness. Older adolescents and adults can practice forgiveness as part of their very identity. Go ahead. Now I'm just going to show you the curriculum. Really quickly, you can see I can love 4 to 5. Love is the building block of forgiveness, the adventure of forgiveness. This goes very slowly through up to the 8th grade with children's cognitive abilities and with stories that are matched to that. Go ahead, please, Penny. And then we get into the high school years and we actually work on the forgiveness process with these kids. And the teacher introduces forgiveness concepts without saying the word. Inherent worth, kindness, respect, generosity, and moral love. Children hear stories with examples of these concepts. The children, or the teachers, help the children apply the forgiveness concepts within their little community of the classroom. Okay. So they do constructive conflict management with forgiveness.
Oh, wow.
Okay, next slide, please. This is Dennis Blank, somebody you can, I think I sent that to you. You have the information though, don't you, Penny, about Dennis Blank. So, and I have some cards up here if you want them. So that's what I have for you today. I have some examples of forgiveness curriculum and some forgiveness books that we can use during the coffee time. But are there any questions for discussions? Go ahead.
Typically.
Well, we do have some in the U.S., but actually, Bob Enright, whom I love, wants to go to the troubled spots of the world, actually. He's chosen those places. He started off in Northern Ireland because of the troubles there. And so that's when, and they have, they go in and they don't teach forgiveness to the kids themselves. They teach the parents and teachers about forgiveness. They have them go through the adult process, and then they teach them about how to teach the kids. And they, some of the schools in Northern Ireland have formed forgiveness schools, forgiveness communities as schools. It's marvelous. Yeah. So we have in our seminar, though, forgiveness therapy seminar, we have people from Saudi Arabia, people from China, people from Taiwan, people from Korea, people from Greece, Slovenia, Slovakia, Liberia, a lot of places, but also the United States. We're working on a racial reconciliation model for the United States, actually. It's a good point. And when we talk with people, we're really gentle about that, because we want to believe their story and tell them that that was really an injury. So we try to use words they can understand. I'm a moral developmental psychologist, so that's why I use those words. But we're really careful with people to have them express themselves and to understand what that injury means to them. And I think what you're getting at is a connection between people. And we're all the same people. We're all the same family. We've all evolved together, right? And so we all want to love and be loved. I think that's the end point. We all want to be in the human community.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
Ann Urbanski is going to read the closing words.
This is actually something we will all read together, so if you can get your order of service, please. This is a forgiveness pledge. By signing this forgiveness pledge, I affirm that forgiveness is an important part of my life. I will do my best to forgive people from my family of origin. I will be a conduit of forgiveness in my family. I will forgive in the workplace and do my best to create a forgiving atmosphere. I will encourage forgiveness in my place of worship so that it is a forgiving community. I will do my best to plant and promote forgiveness in my wider community. I commit to living the forgiving life. Greet your neighbors.
Thank you. Greet your neighbors.